The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Everyone, my name is Jeff Weber. I'm going to be chairing the session. I'm a member of the Editorial Board of Historical Materialism, and you are at the panel Class Composition and Communist Thought in Latin America, in case that's not where you're supposed to be. I have an announcement before we get started that the organizers gave me. The panel, Aesthetic Moment in Marxist Theory, which is on page 17 of the schedule, was kind of mislabeled or something, so it's rescheduled for 11:45, room 435, in case that was important for any of you. Today we have Juan Grijera speaking first on rethinking the pink tide cycle, postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of the Americas at the University College of London, and a researcher at CONICET, the National Research Council of Argentina, and a member of the Editorial Board of Historical Materialism. Robert Kavouras of the History of Consciousness program at University of California, Santa Cruz, and a member of the Editorial Collective of Viewpoint. Sadly, René Savalette Mercado is not here. He is a famous Bolivian Marxist. He's Robert is speaking about this deceased man, so he's not actually an author. Anyway, Christopher Gunderson from Sociology at Howard University, speaking on Zapatismo and Uneven and Combined Development of Communist Thought and Practice, and Jimena Vergara from the Philosophy of Science at UNAM, and a member of the Left Voice Committee. So each of you will have 15 minutes. We'll go in the order of that we're on the program, and then we'll have lots of time for discussion. So Juan, when you are
okay.
Ready.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Thanks everyone for coming today morning. I was almost not making it myself. So. Let me go quickly through this paper because I have only 15 minutes and I will try to pack lots of things today. I try to go back and look a bit at the question of the pink tide for different reasons. One has to do with my own research. It's good to have a look back at what you have once been doing. But the other is, I think, because of its importance, the importance to assess the pink tide for two different problems. One is for Latin America itself, because the pink tide is coming to the end of its cycle, and I think it will be quite critical to understand for future resistance and future any future political projects how we assess the pink tide, and probably I will avoid nostalgic views of it. And the second reason is a bit more broad, and I would say it has an impact globally, and it's because the pink tide was a global exception to neoliberalism. So the region of Latin America had many countries which were not exactly neoliberal, or varieties of neoliberalism, however you wish to call them, but basically were not what was going on everywhere. So we need to think why you can have a region of the world that was certainly having some kind of different questions from a different set than the rest of the world market. And I think that's a problem we should think about and discuss. A final one, it's also because the pink tide was the revival of social democracy. Social democracy was in deep crisis after the third wave and new labor and all that. And it was progressivism and social democracy was revived through projects in this pink tide in Latin America, as we could also see of the influence of the pink tide in European movements such as Podemos in Spain or Syriza in Greece. So let me think. So this is why I think it's important to go on with this debate. And I will quickly map what I think are the main problems with the narratives of a pink tide. I think there are two, broadly speaking, two different narratives. So one is the bunch of explanations that can explain the rise of the pink tide, but are unable to explain their crisis. So basically, all those that say that the pink tide was the rise of social movements and a movement like a successful movement of anti-neoliberal social movement that managed to get to the state are able to explain the rise, but they cannot explain the deny. They can't explain their crisis, and what they do is basically they deny their crisis. They are still thinking that there is no end of the cycle. I'm thinking of Attilio Oron, Emir Saver, even García Linera, and they try to make the pink tide still alive by on the thin grounds of suppose of the results of the Ecuadorian election. I would say that would be the pink drift or something like that. If you go to that, then there is also some another similar set of explanations that also understand the pink tide as a successful. As a successful product or output of social movements from the 90s in resisting neoliberalism, and they cannot explain the demise, and they try to come with a narrative of conspiracy, so U.S. imperialism or the right conspiring, or a narrative of betrayal. So basically, what I'm thinking is they miss the whole point about why the pink tide came to an end. So this is one set. I don't have time to go any longer on those. But then the other set of explanations can explain the demise of the pink tide, but really cannot. So, and then they basically come to what I would call the narrative of normalization. And this is what's been pervasive all through mainstream political science, and so broadly speaking, right, like center-left, center-right or right-wing explanations, saying basically this was some kind of anomaly, the anomaly of populism. What we were expecting is they're back to normality, they're back to neoliberal policies one way or the other. So they were trying to deny the global exception, and they saw the whole thing as an error. So they can't explain the demise, which was they were expecting it anyway, but they can't explain why there was a pink tide in the first place. So that's why I think that's where I think we need an explanation that can explain the whole cycle, why it came to be and why it finished. And there I think I have this is the one I will briefly propose, because I only have 10 minutes left, is one of the few that can do this at the same time. So the key thing to look at is to look at the pink tide not as the successful direct product of social movements, but rather as the bourgeois response to those social movements. So the response to the crisis of domination that was happening in many places in the continent. So once we understand that, we are left with, I would say, two main theoretical devices to do this. One is the one Schiff has been using, also Modonesi or Álvaro Bianchi in Brazil, Rui Braga, which is the idea of passive revolution. And I think that's quite interesting and important. But I will briefly propose today that. That because even though I share many ideas with the idea of passive revolution, and I think it's quite explicit in underlining the question of how social movements were not running the pink tide, but rather being co-opted by it and or selectively repressed or contained one way or the other, but rather my argument about the limits of passive revolution is that it makes an emphasis on, let me say, the superstructural elements, and it's not making explicit link with capital accumulation. So even though most of this literature will point out at the commodity boom, that the commodity boom has a role to play, what I've been trying to look at is at the literature of populism. And even though populism is one of those umbrella terms that's been heavily overused and has many problems, particularly in Latin America, there is a long discussion going on about since the 60s and 70s that has been trying to link the forms of populism and populist rule with specifically capital accumulation and forms of capital accumulation. And that's where I think revisiting those debates is useful in order to do this link, and also, by the way, to criticize other versions of populism at the same time. So I will briefly sketch what I think is useful about populism use in this sense. And in the paper that's behind this presentation, what I do is go back to the discussions of the 60s and 70s, Germani, before, and then the Grupo Itataía, the whole discussion in Latin America, this was basically the first set of explanation that was stemming from the old but but strange, but still useful, I would say, theories of modernization. They try to do two or three things. One is think of populism as a form of the state and not as a movement. So they don't pay attention to the ideological version, but rather to the form of the state. The second one is they try to link it to ISI, and they say there is populism because there is ISI, and they are quite deterministic about this, and they think of populism as a sort of anomaly of modernization, but still they ask, even though I think they have the wrong answer and the wrong method, they ask the question of why can you have populism in certain specific historical moments and not in others. And the third one is they try to show in common, that's something that was common with other versions of the passive revolution before, which is the idea that populism is about institutionalizing social conflict and incorporating certain mobilized groups to the state in response to a crisis of representation. So, of course, this was then revisited by dependency theory, and of course I'm not going to go through the whole debate, but rather I wish to keep only those few points and not the whole argument, which I think is, as I said, pretty deterministic and even sometimes orientalistic, in the sense that Latin America is an anomaly. So while they were expecting the normal modernization stemming liberal democracy, they found populism. What I think is interesting, and this is where Zabaleta has a role as well, is that if you think of how you can have first a crisis of representation, or the crisis of neoliberalism in this case, a crisis of domination, and then you have the state response to that through incorporating social movements, Zabaleta asks the question and says, well, there should be, and there must be, resources to be appropriated by the state. So, and this is where I think there is a this is where I think I've been calling this the enabling condition of populism. I think this is where we should reintroduce the question of capital accumulation. So in the case of ISI, the ISI is the enabling condition in the sense that it's producing there are new resources and the state is able to appropriate new social product. We can discuss this further, but basically this is Zabaleta's argument about Bolivia, and I think this is important, for instance, to criticize other versions of populism, such as Laclau basically has a similar schema where the conditions of populism are the crisis of the some kind of time of crisis of domination and then the incorporation of those movements, but it never tries to reflect on how or where, which are the conditions that make the state able to redistribute. So in all the narratives of populism, even the most vulgar ones, you have the problem of the reconstruction of institutions and the question of redistribution, and they're always forgetting which is the enabling condition in the sense of the state being able to appropriate. So I think in the case of the pink tide populism, we need to think of the commodity boom as the enabling condition of these populisms. And then, so briefly state, the schema I'm proposing is one of crisis of neoliberalism, the need of a bourgeois response, which, by the way, which was not the only response that was attempted. There was also repressive responses, but then this proved a bit more effective. And then the commodity boom actually enabling this redistribution and this incorporation of the social movements. This, and I have to end roughly here, this will show how, if you look at the pink tide as a whole, leads us to a few important points. So one is to look at the most intensive forms of populism linked to the most intensive forms of crisis. So if you look at the crisis of domination in Bolivia or Venezuela, even Argentina, they were stronger and more profound and thus led to more intense forms of populism than the cases of, suppose, Brazil or Uruguay, which are also framed within the pink tide, but were certainly less intensive. The second one, and this is an important point, if you think of populism as the populist state, as a state that's always mediating social conflict and trying to actually to reinstate itself as a social mediator, you understand populism as the historical task of populism as being one of reconstructing that mediation. But also you understand that since it's always mediating, it's a weak state. And it has the weak capacity of the state is one that I think is also missed from the discussion of passive revolution. Because what you can expect the output of a product of a deep crisis of domination is a weak state and not a strong one. So I think those are briefly standpoints on this. We can also discuss, while this explanation roughly explains most of the pink tide and also deviates from the most deterministic, suppose Kurvilen is one who has been arguing that the commodity boom is the one causing the pink tide, and then of course they cannot explain Colombia, for instance, that was also went through the commodity boom, but had no nothing such as a populist or regime, not even a part of the pink tide. Also, this has the ability to explain, as I was saying, a weak state and the differences between the region. So that's briefly state the proposal. I think there's lots to be said, but in 15 minutes, it's what I can give you today. Thanks very much.
So I'm just going to read, and I'm talking about René Zavaleta, who, as Jeff mentioned, was misprinted on the program that he was on the panel, but he is the topic of the talk. René Zavaleta was, among other things, a theorist of historical specificity. In his view, the question of knowledge production was closely related to the historical circumstances of the producer, and therefore to concrete political events. One knows, writes Zavaleta in 1984, according to what one is. The event that would define his own life and work was the 1952 Bolivian National Revolution. In his early period, generally termed his nationalist phase, this was most obvious. But even in subsequent work, and even when he was in exile from Bolivia, his chief concern was always to account for the specificity of Bolivian politics, and in particular, the question of a national project that could give real substance to its existence as a political community. And yet I want to suggest that Zavaleta, a thinker whose work was thus densely tied into his own conjuncture, nonetheless produced a body of knowledge that exceeds it. Despite Zavaleta's deep attachment to and lifelong involvement with the Bolivian nation as a historical project and object of inquiry, I argue that Zavaleta is, at his most insightful, a theorist of the non-nation, that is, of the absence or impossibility of a certain idealist conception of the nation qua political community. That is, if we follow the tendencies in his work to their unrealized conclusions, we find with Zavaleta a conceptual constellation that actually displaces the nation as an object of investigation and deconstructs its premises, opening instead onto the terms of class composition and constituent power. For those familiar with Zavaleta, this argument will maybe come as a surprise. The young Zavaleta was very explicit about his fidelity to the events of April 1952 in Bolivia, when a putsch attempt by the Movimiento Nacionalista Revolucionario was joined in the streets by an uprising of workers, successfully deposing the military government that had been installed 6 years earlier to serve the country's powerful tin barons. Intellectually, he located himself firmly within the revolutionary nationalist tradition that preceded and in part led to that revolution, and which might be characterized, following James Dunkerley, as a poetics of frustrated collectivity. For revolutionary nationalist intellectuals like Carlos Montenegro and Augusto Cespedes, both of whom influenced Zavaleta, the history of Bolivia was a history of impediments to its genuine and organic cohesion. These impediments were external. Colonialism and imperialism had prevented the potential that was a Bolivian nation from the realization toward which it tended. According to Montenegro's reading of this history, each major event since independence only marked one more episode and this is a quote, only marked one more episode in the old struggle between colonialism and nationality. Similarly, Zavaleta writes in 1957, quote, nationality is maintained not in laws, nor in territorial organization, nor merely in secondary norms, but in the people. But the people, at the same time, cannot realize its historical destiny except through independence and autonomy, that is, the realization of the nation. And this is followed in parentheses by noción potencial, potential notion. The idea of potential found throughout the early work of Zavaleta and the other nationalist writers is thus very important here, as it mediates the contradictory, you could even say aporetic relationship between something to come, the Bolivian nation as a normative historical project, and something already in existence, operating under the name of Bolivia, which has inspired a project of nationalism despite lacking the status of a nation. The idea of potential, which I think gestures towards some understanding of an idea of constituent power, is nonetheless predefined as national potential. If the supposedly ascendant unity of the Bolivian nation leading up to and initially following 1952 suggests this one teleological reading of history, then the actual difficulties that plagued the revolutionary project would suggest another. By the time Zavaleta became a parliamentary deputy of the MNR, the Movimiento Nacionalista Revolucionario, in 1962, he already acknowledged the political realities that pointed to the irreducible heterogeneity of a would-be national subject. The contradictions of the class alliance comprised by the MNR were becoming clear. The MNR government had accepted the dictates of an IMF economic stabilization plan in 1956, which severely limited their concessions to workers. They then reanimated the military, which had been all but defeated in the events of 1952, and proceeded to use it to repress powerful tin miners' unions in their rebellion against these proto-neoliberal reforms. Zavaleta was part of a revolutionary wing of the party, arguing that the only way out of the growing economic crisis was instead a full embrace of socialist, state-led industrial development and an expansion of the proletariat beyond the mining industry. Any attempt to compete on capitalist terms, he argued, on a world scale, would only lead to the country's continued exploitation. 2 years later, in 1964, Zavaleta became Minister of Mining and, perhaps not coincidentally, softened this explicit commitment to a socialist resolution. But in any case, by November of 1964, it would cease to matter. A coup by René Barrientos put an end to the MNR government for the moment, and Zavaleta went into exile. Canonically, this is said to mark the end of Zavaleta's initial nationalist phase and his entry into what is called often an orthodox Marxist phase. And then this phase, in turn, gave way by the 1980s to a more heterodox and creative phase. So having laid out the general framework of this early nationalism, as well as some of its contradictions and challenges, I'm going to jump ahead to this last phase. I think it's the most theoretically interesting. But it will suffice to note that in the intervening period, and Diego Martín Giller has argued this, this intervening period was marked by a shift from a sort of general emphasis on the exterior conditions of Bolivia's national non-development, it's referring to imperial and colonial relations, to a more sustained engagement with the internal historical dynamics of Bolivia, above all relating to class relations and the state form. Still, even by the last phase of his career, an important question persisted for Zavaleta. If Bolivia was not yet a nation, if this was still its historic task, then what was it? By what right did one speak of Bolivia as an entity other than just a state, or claim to produce knowledge of this entity? And what concepts and theories might be used to do so? Lo Nacional Popular en Bolivia is a sustained, this is one of Zavaleta's works, is a sustained but unfortunately unfinished attempt to address this question, as Zavaleta died in 1984 before its completion. Other major texts of that same period, such as Cuatro Conceptos de la Democracia and Las Masas en Noviembre, likewise offer a window into this late problematic and the epistemological challenges there. The investigation in Lo Nacional Popular is obviously still concerned with the historical possibilities and impossibilities of a Bolivian nation, and its form, the work's form, runs parallel to that of Montenegro's famous Nacionalismo y Coloniaje, tracing the question of the nation through various historical episodes. But here, Zavaleta rejects what he calls a certain Manichaeism that does not allow for explanations of varying forms of articulation within this history. In other words, it's not enough at this point for him to speak of a struggle between national potential and the things which stifle it. He writes, quote, "By contrast, what interests us is to observe the contradictory development of factors. It is as if men proposed something and the facts brought them inevitably somewhere else." Zavaleta is still interested in constituent power here. Lo Nacional Popular revolves around constitutive moments where potential meets factuality and where possibilities historically settled into a concrete existence. Yet in order to understand how he now analyzes these moments in this late work, I argue that we need to set up a distinction between two conceptual registers that appear in this work. And so this, he does not talk about his own concepts in terms of these two registers. This is sort of my interpretive argument. The first is a register of what he does call totalization, and this is a level of investigation permitted, in his reading of Marx, by the insight that history under capitalism involves a compression of time and an increased density of social space. Historical transformation happens much more quickly within capitalism than ever before, and historical events are amplified, their effects potentially more widespread. This character of capitalism, in Savalleta's reading, is what makes total, politically directed, which is to say revolutionary, transformation possible. In this epistemological register, Savalleta highlights a number of concepts, and the key one, I think, is social democratization. He cites Weber to define this as a process of the development of juridically free, unattached individuals with the kinds of civil and political equality that make formal democracy possible. Savalleta supplements this idea with Marx's discussion of the state of separation, which a breakdown of pre-capitalist relationships lays the groundwork for the doubly free laborer and the introduction and perhaps generalization of wage labor. Savalleta notes that in the process of social social democratization is a condition for new forms of intersubjectivity, which he calls the interaction between free men who recognize themselves as such. He elaborates this point this way, quote, "It is thus this generalized interaction or intersubjectivity, the consequence of a total circulation of subjects, which is responsible for the construction of the great modern totalizations from social classes, which for this reason do not appear similar to those of any other epoch, to the multitude or the masses, from the nation to the state." You can see that this process of the creation of individuals thus underlies all possibilities, according to Savalleta, for new political and social modes of unity within capitalism. Totalization is therefore characterized as a process of construction of, quote, "the internal market, nation-state, bourgeois democratic continuum," end quote. It may seem at points as if Savalleta speaks of this process of social democratization as having been completely achieved in certain societies or parts of the world, which would then be counterposed to the specific situations of dependent countries like Bolivia. The supposed homogeneity and effective creation of juridically free individuals in places like presumably Europe would then be the norm, and other cases, a deviation. We would then be entering the familiar territory of some supposed barrier between possible forms of knowledge proper to one kind of society or another, even within capitalism. Or we could interpret this process of social democratization, as Savalleta talks about it, as a teleological component of capitalism. Whether totalization has yet been achieved anywhere or not, it would represent the future of capitalism, and its fulfillment would make possible a total transformation towards socialism. Yet by suggesting that this discussion of totalization only represents one of two conceptual registers in Savalleta's work, I'm proposing a different distinction with no correspondence to an east-west, north-south, or north-south division, nor the presumption of a unilinear and predetermined future for capitalism followed by socialism. If Savalleta speaks in this first register through the work of the earliest theorists of capitalist society, Marx and Weber, it's because these two thinkers observed something that was indeed new to capitalism, but which nonetheless was not actually universal or even total, you could say, in its effects. What they observed and what Savalleta approaches with the discussion of totalization is rather a tendency. The tendency underlying all the concepts of totalization can be thought, I argue, as the decomposition of older social forms and classes, as well as a breakdown of constituted powers that previously reigned, having the effect of freeing and atomizing the modern individual. If this is the case, then the second register in Savalleta's later work is precisely the opposite. This is the register of composition. And this refers to both the remainders of those social and class elements that survive processes of decomposition with the introduction of capitalism, but also their rearticulation alongside new forms and new possibilities. The concepts under this heading of composition can then likewise be read as tendential, or what amounts to the same thing, counter-tendential. Thus, we find here an array of notions by which Savalleta speaks not to capitalism's necessary developments, but rather to the contingencies of social and class relationships as they emerge and change. And so I'll just mention a few. One of these key concepts for Savalleta is accumulation. he says accumulation in the heart of the class or accumulation in the masses, which is his way of discussing the preservation and circulation of historical memory as it affects different classes and their political possibilities. He also has a concept of the primordial form, which he introduces to refute the possibility of a general theory of dependency by focusing attention instead on the specific pre-existing social elements that are rearticulated in different colonial relations. And then there's the famous concept of ideological interpolation, which he draws from Althusser. But this poses a sort of difference to his idea of intersubjectivity. So while intersubjectivity might denote the forms of experience made possible by the abstraction of individuals and market relations, ideology instead refers to the elements of power by which particular ideas are emitted or infused on the part of the state in the terrain of class struggle. The important thing here, this is sort of what I'm getting at, is that when we think about these two conceptual registers, sort of totalization and decomposition on the one hand and class composition on the other, we're thinking about two simultaneous historical processes introduced by capitalism and having their effects in distinct, this is Zavaleta's term that he comes to in his late works, economic social formations. One of Zavaleta's most cited concepts is that of the sociedad abigarrada, translated often as motley society. This term encapsulates, I think, the ongoing and uneven results that come from these two simultaneous processes, referring to the articulation of different elements within capitalism unleashed in non-uniform and perhaps unexpected ways. And it's in this sense that I say that Zavaleta is a theorist of the non-nation, because ultimately his work recognizes the very things that make the modern nation, as he conceived it, possible, as sort of an intersubjective community of individuals who recognize each other and think themselves as part of a whole, also opens up a set of motley possibilities and alternative forms of unity and relation that prevent the total closure of a political community into the nation form. The point is not that nations do not exist in some sense, but rather that nationality always finds its place among struggles between classes with distinct histories, where past social forms persist, where state apparatuses structure, divide, condense and displace different ideologies. In short, there are no pure ideal nations, and the relationship of the nation to socialist revolution then becomes somewhat ambiguous. And if we take this insight seriously, this is my last point, I think that the condition of the motley society cannot be restricted to Bolivia, it cannot be restricted to post-colonial territories. It's rather something that speaks to the very dynamics of capitalism everywhere it exists. And this motley character, I think, becomes most visible precisely where capitalism brings classes into compositions beyond or alongside nationality. So thinking about the material links that connect, say, factory workers in one part of the world to self-employed, informal merchants through international supply chains, or in reconstituted communal forms that migrants sometimes bring with them across borders from rural homelands to urban megacities where they get rearticulated in different ways, or even in solidarity organizations that seek to overcome racial fissures that have always belied any supposedly general social equality, even in the so-called advanced capitalist countries. So it would be a mistake, for obvious reasons, I think, to suggest that we live in a post-national world. But the lesson that Zavaleta learned, perhaps with some disappointment, may for us instead strike a hopeful note, that even when nationalism is on the agenda, class struggle, sometimes despite itself, presents alternative possibilities. Thank you.
Thank you. The title of this paper is Zapatismo and the Uneven and Combined Development of Communist Thought and Practice. This paper grows out of my research on the origins and developments of the distinctive politics of the Zapatista National Liberation Army, known as Zapatismo, in the course of which I was compelled to address the character and role of communist organizations and of communism in that process. This is what I'm doing here is an initial attempt predicated on a hunch, to distill in more theoretical terms what I've largely presented in the past in narrative form, though I will give a sort of capsule version of the narrative that I'm attempting to theorize. So I look at basically the deep roots of the political consciousness and collective subjectivity of the indigenous communities that formed the base of the Zapatista National Liberation Army, going back to the colonial period and indigenous revolts in that time and proceeding up to the eve of the 1994 rebellion. In 1712, virtually all of the Celtal Mayan towns and villages of eastern Chiapas, then a part of colonial Guatemala, and drawing on traditions of village communal self-governance, rose up in revolt against their Spanish colonial overlords. In the brief course of the revolt, which proclaimed its desire for a world ruled by neither God nor king, the indigenous rebels organized themselves along the lines of a proto-communist theocracy, not unlike that proclaimed by Thomas Münzer in the German Peasant War. In 1869, a century and a half later, the Tzotzil Mayan towns and villages in the highland municipality of Chamula, under the influence of a Spanish anarchist school teacher, Galindo, rose up against the authority of local landed elite, the Catholic hierarchy, and state government. In the context of the Mexican Revolution in the 19-teens and 20s, the first labor unions and explicitly socialist political organizations established themselves among the largely indigenous migrant coffee plantation workers in the Pacific coastal region of Soconusco. By the late 1920s, a communist party of Soconusco was established that in the early 30s would merge with the Mexican Communist Party. And there's a, I think, fascinating dissertation to be written there. In the 1930s, the Communist Party was drawn into supporting the demands of its indigenous migrant worker members for land reform in their home villages back in the highland areas of Chiapas. This was followed by something of a lull. But in the 1960s, the Catholic Diocese of San Cristobal, influenced by what would come to be known as liberation theology, trained thousands of young indigenous campesino catechists to critically analyze the immiserated conditions of their communities as consequences of racism, colonialism, and capitalist exploitation. In the early and mid-1970s, Maoist students emerging from the student movement of the late 1960s, mainly from northern universities in northern Mexico, assisted the indigenous communities of Chiapas in the construction of mass campesino organizations, utilizing popular assemblies and participatory democratic forms to incorporate very large numbers of folks in some very heated struggles. Parallel to this, though occurring a little later in the 70s, a clandestine political military organization, the Forces of National Liberation, or the FLN, influenced by the Cuban and Nicaraguan revolutions, began to recruit young indigenous men and women to receive political education and military training in their network of urban safe houses. In the 1980s, a guerrilla nucleus composed of indigenous members of the FLN, indigenous and non-indigenous members of the FLN, established an encampment in the mountains of the Lacandon jungle, declared themselves the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or EZLN, and began to recruit individuals and eventually whole villages and regions that had been previously organized with the assistance of the diocese and the Maoists. This capsule history give some sense of the variety of influences that converged in the indigenous communities of eastern Chiapas to produce the distinctive politics of the EZLN, which I argue exercised an important influence on the revitalization of revolutionary anti-capitalist politics in the late 1990s and to the present. It also illustrates, I would like to argue, how At each of these moments, as I've just described, we see a communist or proto-communist ideas and practices playing an important role in the developing political subjectivity of the indigenous communities of Chiapas, and I can sort of elaborate on those in questions if people want. Each of these moments, I would like to argue, are expressions of the communist movement, understood here as the real movement to overthrow the oppressive and exploitive conditions of class society in general, and of capitalism in particular. Looking at each, we can see that they have distinct and particular characteristics. The indigenous theocratic proto-communism of the 1712 Celtal Rebellion, for example, is obviously not the same as the communism of either the Maoist students or the would-be guerrillas of the Forces of National Liberation. These differences are the result of both the different spatial and temporal contexts in which each expression emerged, and the processes of circulation, of struggles, and syntheses of previous experiences that they contain. It is fruitful to think of each as a partial and fragmentary expression of a larger and still very much emergent communist movement, the aims of which Marx defines in his discussion of the 1848 revolution as the abolition of class distinctions generally, the abolition of all relations of production on which they rest, the abolition of all the social relations that correspond to these relations of production, and finally, the revolutionizing of all the ideas that result from these social relations. And I view this as sort of measurement against which we can look at each of the individual instances. The history of that movement is, of course, marked by nodal moments: the publication of the Manifesto, the Paris Commune, the Russian, Chinese, and other socialist revolutions of the 20th century, which can be understood as both attempts to overcome the partial and fragmentary character of what has gone before, but that are still constrained by the particularities of the times and places in which they occurred. I would like to propose here that these particularities and their relationship to the communist movement as a whole is illuminated by a conceptualization of the uneven and combined development of communist theory and practice. And here's where I'm sort of trying to develop a hunch. I'm not a Trotskyist, but I give respect to where it's due, and I think Trotsky's theory of uneven combined development has something to offer here, even if I'm developing it in a more analogical way. That theory, articulated first in the chapter of History of the Russian Revolution, has been used primarily to explain the distinctive forces and relations of production, class structures, and corresponding politics of national and regional social formations. More recently, as Anieves and Nisangelu explain in How the West Came to Rule, it has, quote, enjoyed an unprecedented revival in the disciplines of international relations, development studies, and historical sociology. This revival, however, has involved, to varying degrees, reconceptualizations of the theory. And in Anieves and Nisangelu's work, which prompted me to consider the theory's application to the question of the relationship of Zapatismo to the development of communist theory and practice, it involves a wholesale challenge to the Eurocentrism of the dominant Marxist understandings, including those of Trotsky, of the emergence and development of capitalism. It is this conceptualization that I'm taking as my starting point. Anieves and Nisangelu's work echoes in important ways Samir Amin's theory of unequal development and Abu Lugod's account of the development of the world system in the period immediately preceding the rise of European hegemony in the 16th century, neither of which rely on Trotsky's conceptualization of the theory of uneven combined development, which I think is an important addition here. Both of which understand capitalism's emergence first in Europe as a privilege of its historical backwardness vis-a-vis the more developed tributary regimes of China, India, and the Arab world. It is the combined and uneven development of the tributary mode of production in Western Europe in the form of feudalism and its embeddedness within a geopolitical context powerfully shaped by events and processes outside of Europe that contributed to the crisis in that mode of production, and that explains that explains not only the emergence of a North Atlantic-centered capitalist world system and the Industrial Revolution, but also the emergence of its antithesis in the form of the modern communist movement. What I'm interested in developing here is a theory of combined and uneven development of communist theory and practice that does not stop with the October revolutions and the controversies that arose within Bolshevism, but rather that takes seriously the continued development of that theory in the course of revolutionary struggles all around the world over the course of the 20th century. And in my case here, those would include in China, Cuba, and Nicaragua, for example, but also less obviously socialist or communist-led struggles for national liberation in Africa, which exercised an important influence on liberation theology and, in particular, its understanding of the indigenous question. All of these contributed in important ways to the emergence of Zapatismo in Mexico and to its contributions to, as I said, the revitalization of revolutionary anti-capitalist theory and practice since the 1990s. And here I'm sort of interested in the possibilities of I think overcoming a Eurocentrism in our understanding of the historical development of communist theory that takes its emergence first in its modern form in Europe as an expression of the priority of Europe, but then I think fails to adequately deal with the movement of the center of revolutionary activity over the past century and a half or so, from Europe, then to Russia, to Asia, to the rest of the former colonial world, and I think underappreciates the significance of the developments that occurred within all of those various forms. For understanding our new situation, and I believe that the story of the development of the distinctive politics of the Zapatismo, which I have not gotten into here other than in the form of that narrative, is illustrative of that and is suggestive of the importance of recentering some of those other traditions of communist thought that I think powerfully influenced the Zapatistas, even if that is not widely recognized. And I'm actually under time, so that almost never happens.
Thank you. Okay, so I think internationalism is a strategic necessity. So, because efforts to fight capitalism will come to nothing without solidarity between workers of all countries. To paraphrase Marx, class struggles are national in their form and international in their content. The left, I think, and the American working class cannot defeat capitalism if they do not remain conscious that US imperialism actively oppresses and exploits the semi-colonial world. So in this talk, I hope to scratch the surface of the ways in which the US oppresses and exploits Mexico, and the effects this has on Mexican society. And I'm going to explore the transformations in Mexican economy, politics, and society after 25 years of NAFTA, with a focus on the emergence of a new working class as a consequence of this. This new working class is invisible to many leftists and academics. I'm sure the usual discussions about Mexico focus on the incredible violence suffered as a result of the drug trafficking and femicides, like in famous case of the 43 students missing in Ayotzinapa. Of course, everyone knows Mexico because of the great rebellion of the Zapatistas. I think in Mexico, class struggle in the last quarter century has been protagonized by the allies of the proletariat, you know, the peasants and the native peoples. This strongly argued that speaking of the working class today, it's anachronistic for both intellectuals and most of the Mexican left. I don't think it is at all anachronistic to discuss the Mexican working class. In fact, it is central to developing an understanding of global production and the US economy. As we discussed in the opening plenary of this conference, the global working class is currently very heterogeneous, due not only to national difference, but also because in the last 20 years, a new global division of labor has emerged. As a result of Mexico's transformation into a manufacturing export platform for US industry and the trend towards the replacement of oil exports by manufacturing companies and the growth of the automotive chain of production in recent years, Mexico has a proletariat of about 42 million employees, of whom at least 11 million are in manufacturing, oil, and mining. And the most important aspect of the situation is that the proletariat, which remained dormant and did not mobilize for a long time, has begun to wake up. As the Mexican proletariat became larger, their living conditions worsened to historic lows, which are the living conditions for most of Mexico today. So I think imperialist penetration, like any civilizing process, in quotes, in capitalism, create monstrous phenomena such as drug trafficking, femicide, human trafficking, and migration in subhuman conditions, and cause countless deaths of people trying to cross the border. I am going to explore three aspects of US imperialist penetration: drug trafficking and the war on drugs, NAFTA and its consequences, and the situation of the working class, okay? So, Mexico shares 3,200 kilometers of border with the United States. We have a saying that says, poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States. We do not refer to the workers and the American people, of course, but to the government, Democrats and Republicans, both. There has been US intervention in Mexico since the 18th century, but it has escalated in the past 25 years. On January 1st of 1994, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was put into effect at the same time that the Zapatista Rebellion broke out in the south of the country with the slogans, Abajo el mal gobierno, down with the bad government, and stop the NAFTA. The implementation of NAFTA began an economic cycle in Mexico that is now in crisis, not only because of the economic cataclysm of 2008, but also because of the rise of Donald Trump. Mexico exports labor, raw materials, and narcotics to its northern neighbor, while the United States invests a massive amount of capital, which gave birth to the Maquiladora Corridor on the northern border. Goods, capital, and people are constantly crossing the border, both legally and illegally. This constant flux gives illegal economic sectors unique characteristics, specifically the US demand for immigrant labor. Sex trafficking and drugs has created an economic niche that exists on the margins of the state, but at the same time unsupported by the state. The dispute is violent, and I do not mean this symbolically. Organized crime uses paramilitary groups to defend their market, and at the same time, in association with the state, uses violence against the poor and working classes. An infamous example of this was the murder and torture of 100 migrants in Tamaulipas in 2013. They were in a truck attempting to come to the US when narcos stopped them and attempted to recruit them to the drug cartels. Because these migrants refused, they were brutally murdered. Other victims of organized crime and the army, those who stand in political opposition against government, like the 43 students of Ayotzinapa. The role of privileged distributors of cocaine and amphetamines to the United States has conferred exorbitant power on Mexican cartels. And they are now large global capitalist corporations operating in several countries. Ultimately, the market for narcotics and other illegal industries quickly generates the massive amount of capital, which is then put into circulation through money laundering. The response of the Mexican and US governments to the growth of drug trafficking was militarization, which only increased the violence. The so-called war against drug trafficking that been waged against Mexico for more than 10 years was mandated by the White House under the instruction and operation of U.S. intelligence agencies and armed forces sectors. The results have been devastating. Even the most conservative figures estimate 160,000 deaths, 25 million displaced, and an uncertain number of missing persons ranging from 25,000 to 45,000. So I'm going to go on the discuss of the NAFTA and its effects on the working class. But to understand Mexico, it's essential to understand that all of these events are occurring in the very in this very violent context. With NAFTA, the Mexican economy developed a manufacturing industry that was entirely dependent on transnational corporations. Far from what Donald Trump poses, NAFTA create immense profits for U.S. transnational capital, not only by creating low-cost goods for U.S. consumption, but also opening Mexico to subsidize American products. The most emblematic example is corn, which is the basis of the Mexican diet and makes up 60% of national agricultural production. With NAFTA, the government authorized the entry of 2.5 million metric tons of duty-free corn. The Mexican corn field was left with no possibility of competing with corn imported from the United States because, of course, agricultural productivity in the United States is higher than the Mexican. Peasant organizations report that the United States government subsidized corn at 30% of production cost, while Mexican government subsidy does not reach even 9%. Corn is perhaps the most glaring example of this dynamic that has left rural farmers completely ruined and has led to around 300 people a year migrating to the industrialized cities or the United States. These make up the new Mexican working class who sell their labor for pennies and create low-cost products for the U.S. So, Mexico is part of one of the most dynamic value chains in the world, the automotive chain of NAFTA member countries. The need to compete with other countries that receive massive flows of foreign direct investment led the Mexican government to maintain the lowest wage among the member countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, causing some economists to label Mexico the China of the West. 80% of manufacturing production in Mexico is exported to the United States. At the same time, the Mexican foreign debt, whose primary creditor is the U.S., is $424 billion. Thank you. As was discussed in the opening session, the working class has been seriously defeated, fragmented, and in worse condition after the neoliberal offensive. But things are changing. It is not a coincidence that at this conference, the opening plenary was dedicated to a discussion of the state of the working class. For almost a quarter of a century, the working class of the Mexican North was silent, suffering the most degraded condition under imperialist penetration. This working class on the border is composed mainly of indigenous or ex-peasant women that travel along to work in the industrialized cities, leaving behind their families and often their children. They live on the outskirts of the city without drinkable water or sometimes without water at all. The streets have no asphalt or electrical lighting, and it's too dangerous for women to walk alone. Femicides are common not only due to sexist violence, which occurs throughout the country. In border towns, femicide is due to a complex network that includes the government, the police, the narcos, and the bosses. For many years, these women organized against femicide in order to look for the disappeared and demand justice. They did so as friends, as sisters, and as family members, but not as the working class. This began to change in 2014, when women began to organize in the factory to fight for higher pay, but also against sexual harassment and the right to a union. At the end of last year, labor struggles erupted in Foxconn, Comscrom, Itchan, ADC Lexmer, Lear, etc. I'm sorry. During the 2016 and early 2017 struggles were recorded in the maquiladoras of Sonora, Chihuahua, and Coahuila. During 2015 and 2016, indigenous agricultural workers in San Quintín carried out one of the most important labor struggles of recent years. 35,000 day laborers demanded the right to unionization and a salary increase. Thousands of workers spearheaded radicalized actions, such blocking the transcontinental highway linking Baja California Norte with Baja California Sur, to defend the road blockage they fought against the army. In this context, in 2016 arose the candidacy of the maquila worker Antonia Hinojos, Toñita, as mayor of Ciudad Juárez. This is quite disruptive because she denounced the capitalist parties for governing for the bosses and not for the working class. She denounced the exploitation of workers in the factories owned by transnational companies and was a political voice of the maquiladoras. So, capitalist development in the past quarter century has profoundly transformed the structure of the world economy. The fact that different components of the same goods are produced in different parts of the world has created a new international division of labor. This new working class, which is limited in its movement by borders and migration restriction, is heterogeneous and fragmented. On the other hand, capital has almost absolute mobility, which has led to competition among workers of different countries like never before in the history of capitalism. As a result, the wage gap between different countries has grown. In Mexico, the average wage is $4 a day, 80 Mexican pesos, compared to $32 in the United States. The xenophobic and racist rhetoric against Mexican immigrants is aimed at reinforcing this competition among workers. To counter this division, labor unions and workers in the U.S. must fight against the exploitation of workers in Mexico and counter Trump's chauvinistic discourse of America First and the chauvinistic discourse of the labor bureaucracy who calls for us to buy American. At the same time, workers in the U.S. need to embrace the struggle for all rights for undocumented workers. This has the potential to unite native and foreign born workers in the U.S. with the millions of workers in Mexico in a fight against the same bosses. The only way in which the situation of millions of workers employing NAFTA member countries can possibly improve is to bring about the end of the imperialist oppression of Mexico and Central America and capitalist exploitation of both sides of the border. And this is concrete, I think. Leon Trotsky wrote to the British Labour Party in 1938, when the Mexican oil was expropriated, that in Mexico, visit any center of the mining industry, hundreds of millions of dollars extracted by foreign capital from the earth have given nothing whatever to the culture of the country, to the culture on the country. Neither highways, nor buildings, nor good development of the cities. Even the promises of the companies themselves often resemble barracks. Why, indeed, should one spend Mexican oil, Mexican gold, Mexican silver on the needs of faraway and alien Mexico when with the profits obtained it is possible to build palaces, museums, theaters in London or in Monaco, and I would say in New York. Such are the civilizers. In the place of historical riches that live shaped in the Mexican soil and ill health among the Mexican workers. I think we can affirm with assurance the further development of the attempts of Trump and imperialism against the independence of Mexico will to a great degree depend upon the conduct of the US working class and the left. Firm resoluteness is necessary to paralyze the criminal hand of imperialist violence in Mexico. Thank you very much.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.